Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Tony Salvaggio. Tony Salvaggio is an assistant professor of sociology at Humboldt State University. He's also a founding faculty member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research and is on the faculty of the Environmental and Community Masters Program. He's also on the board of directors for the Environmental Protection Information Center and has decades of experience in grassroots environmental and social justice activism. So first off, Tony, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek, and glad to join you. It's an important topic right now, and glad to be here.
Okay, so before we start, just so people don't get the idea that we are fanatical Christians who hate anything weed-associated, let's just get on the record that both of us have advocated for medical marijuana and find that it is useful for many things. And then from there, let's step up to also say that we recognize that that there are problems in industrial marijuana production that need to be discussed.
I agree.
So would you like to talk about some of those, especially environmental problems associated with industrial marijuana, and you mentioned before we started that you have a new paper out, and perhaps that would be discussing some of the issues in that paper would be helpful too.
Yeah, the piece is Cannabis Agriculture in California, and I talk about the environmental consequences of prohibition. But maybe before that, I just give you a little bit of background on how I got on to study this topic. I'm an environmental sociologist whose early research was focused on primarily sort of issues around forestry and the timber industry. And when I moved back to Humboldt County, California, for those that don't know about Humboldt County, we are the center of the universe, if you will, for cannabis culture and cannabis agriculture. The cannabis industry has been around since the 1960s and early 70s, and it sort of dominates the landscape, both, as I said, culturally as well as economically. When I returned here, I got my master's degree here in the 90s, and this was right around the time of Proposition 215, the sort of medical cannabis legislation that was passed, the first medical cannabis law passed in the states. And, and what we saw there is this sort of this explosion of production, if you will, because now folks had sort of a legal justification for growing it. We see it sort of an intake and in, I would say an increase in production, indoor production. But when I came back here in 2005, I was visiting farms out in the hills, and I was just amazed at the amount of not only habitat destruction that was going on in the hills, but also sort of the toxic mix of chemicals and fertilizers that people were using to grow cannabis. And I started to do research on this at around 2010, 2011 to really sort of investigate this particular issue. And the environmental consequences of cannabis, I would say unregulated cannabis agriculture, are really extensive, and the damages range from things like habitat loss, fragmentation from illegal logging. You have illegal water diversions, dewatering of streams. You have illegal road building, grading, as well as fertilizer, pesticide, fungicide, and fossil fuel runoff into waterways and into creeks. So the consequences of unregulated cannabis agriculture are extensive here. And one of the things I guess I should point out too before we get into this more anymore is, you know, there are some distinctions that we need to make when we talk about cannabis agriculture. One of them is the sort of difference between industrial cannabis production and then sort of the mom and pop, right? The industrial cannabis production is large scale, sort of big ag, if you will, you know, where there are thousands and thousands of plants, versus the sort of small scale farming that was the traditional model here in the 1970s and 80s. And then the other dimension, which is important, and the media always seems to conflate these, is we have the sort of public lands issues, and we have the private lands issues. So public lands, we're talking about state and national forests. We have environmental impacts of cannabis on those lands, and then we have the sort of private lands issues where people have their own, they own the property. And those issues are somewhat different. So, I guess we can unpack those if you'd like. But I think the each of these have to be understood in the context of a regulatory environment, which sort of makes it difficult for cannabis growers to actually, you know, do the right thing. So I consider the environmental consequences of cannabis agriculture as almost an unintended consequence of prohibition, if you will.
So let's get to them being the unintended consequence of prohibition. But for now, let's back up and unpack some of those.
Okay. So some of the environmental issues?
Yeah, environmental issues, and also so some things to unpack might be the specific environmental issues, mm-hmm. And the distinction between the mom and pop and the, at this point we're talking illegal industrial, right, in California, as opposed to regular industrial, which they're certainly getting in Colorado and Oregon.
Well, you know, that right now, I mean, everything's federally illegal, of course. In California, there's nothing. I mean, what is legal now is medical, and medical industrial is legal at this present time. Recreational industrial is not. So there are folks that are, you know, and there are warehouses that are growing thousands of plants, right, both indoor and outdoor, that are legal in California under the medical, the current medical legislation, right? Things won't go into effect. The new legislation won't go into effect until January of this year, and that piece is the it's a strange acronym. It's like MCRSA, if you will. It's the Medicinal and Adult Use Cannabis Regulation Safety Act, and that's going to be the law that is used for recreational. So let's just talk a little bit about some of the, you know, what we're seeing on the ground in impacts. You know, folks for many years thought that cannabis was this sort of green, eco-groovy product. And of course, in the 1960s, it certainly was with the cottage industry that emerged here. However, you know, over the course of the last 20 plus years of prohibition, what we see an industry that has emerged where the practices are of course damaging. So like in terms of the environmental impacts, you know, as I said earlier, you know, outdoor impacts, we see on public lands in particular, we see habitat destruction, we see poaching of critters, we see you know, pollution and the dewatering of streams. We also see things like nutrient and soil and fertilizer loading into waterways, which affects aquatic habitats.
Can you give a sense of the scale of this? Because I think a lot of people, when they think about marijuana, they might just think, as you said, you know, somebody growing 12 or 15 or 20 plants in their backyard. But this has a significant, for example, dewatering. I mean, can you give a sense of scale on some of this too, please?
So, you know, in terms of some, I mean, it again, it depends on region. I mean, right now in my county, in this tri-county area, there's an estimated 10,000 cannabis farms, 10,000 cannabis growers, outdoor cannabis cultivators right now. And, you know, most of these are in very remote places where cannabis agriculture is basically not good for the land. And in some situations, we find that cannabis is actually dewatering salmon-bearing streams, taking up to 75% of water from those creeks during the sort of dry period, basically dewatering salmon habitat for cannabis agriculture, and that's on private lands. On public lands, we have similar sorts of things happening where people are basically damming up creeks and waterways, diverting that water to cannabis crops. And you're talking about at least on private land, on public lands, some eradications have been in the hundreds of thousands, 100,000 plants, right? You're talking football field size of areas and just scattered throughout national parks and public lands, national forests and public lands. So the scale is the scale is expanding every year, right? And with new legislation to legalize, and this is one of the things that I've uncovered in my research, is that every attempt to legalize cannabis, every sort of political effort, leads to an increase in production statewide. So, for example, a few years back, there was an attempt in Canada or in BC to legalize cannabis. So everybody in California, because this is our bread and butter, at least in my county, was freaking out, and people were thinking this is the last run, and what happens is they double production. And that was, I want to say, 8 years ago. And every year there's another state that has something on the ballot. So there's sort of a political environment really shapes shapes the industry and the industry expansion. So every year there's more and more people coming to California to grow cannabis, right? And that's both on public lands and private lands. And that scale has increased. Over the course of the last 5 years, you know, the price has also dropped, which leads people to, you know, grow even more, right, to make their bottom line, either their payments on their houses or their land, or to pay their workers. So, I mean, the scale's increased exponentially in terms of growth on both public and private lands, even with Google Earth, right? People are still expanding production. So, you know, we have 10,000, Derek, 10,000. That's huge. And it's a billion-dollar industry in California and multi-billion-dollar industries nationwide.
So, just a little bit more on specifics of environmental degradation. I've heard, for example, about martens are one target that has been hit. Can you just give a couple quick stories on any sort of environmental degradation, and then we'll move on.
So you're talking specifically about sort of public lands issues of cannabis, and as I said earlier, there's some different impacts between public and private lands. So with public lands, you know, these are called trespass grows, where, you know, people get together. We call them, you know, the law enforcement likes to use the term, this sort of culturally coded racist term, cartel, right? But I just use generally organized crime, just a bunch of people getting together and sort of putting resources towards setting up a farm on public lands. And what happens is they go to the most remote places, and those places are then deforested or cleared, if they haven't been cleared already. And in order to sort of water the plants and set up the whole scene, they dewater the area. But to protect their crop from critters, you know, wood rats, mice, and other animals, what these sort of organized crime networks have done is they've laid what some consider, it's called second generation rodenticides. And they basically line their fields with these rodenticides in order to prevent critters from eating the cannabis. They're also referred to as sort of like pesticide fences, where they'll literally they'll drop a foot square strip around the crop so that anything that crosses into this area gets exposed to this pesticide or rodenticide. And the rodenticide, and there's a very important researcher named Murad Gabriel who really helped to highlight the impact on one particular critter, the marten. But what's interesting about these rodenticides is that the second generation that they put in, like flavonoids, the company put in flavonoids, and it's, you know, to give you an indication of how damaging these things are and to critters is, like, you know, think of like you're walking through maybe a tailgate party at an event or at a concert. You smell a barbecue, like you smell that barbecue, you get hungry and you want to go towards that barbecue. And these rodenticides, they've added sort of this flavonoid so that it smells like a barbecue to critters. And then critters go, they are attracted to them. So you know, there's the primary kill of a rat or a mouse, and that primary kill then you know, pine martens, that's their food source, so they then eat that critter, birds of prey eat that critter, and then we see that sort of bioaccumulation, and it's had a devastating effect on the marten. Murad Gabriel's research points to some locations in the Sierras where, you know, over 3/4 of the martens he's tested have this rodenticide in them, and you're talking martens that are literally miles from human sort of habitation. So the only real explanation for how these critters got poisoned is cannabis farmers on public lands, trespass grows. So he's been working over the last decade on really sort of highlighting these impacts, and it's a really important work. So that's just, you know, one impact on a critter that's a threatened species in California that this industry has. And again, I think a lot of this we need to connect to sort of what I try to connect it to is prohibition. Right, and it's not simply these unscrupulous cannabis growers, but the drug war policies themselves that have really exacerbated environmental devastation on public and private lands.
Well, I think that this makes a good transition into that. So please explain why this is not just a bunch of greedy jerks.
Well, not to say that there's not those out there, because there certainly are those out there.
That's called capitalism.
Yeah, industrial capitalism. You know, I think that, you know, taking a sort of socio-historical context, looking at the socio-historical context of cannabis industry, you know, looking at how it emerged, I mean, in the 1960s we had, as I said earlier, it sort of, this production of cannabis emerged here in the 70s with the Back to the Land movement up here in Northern California. And you had, you know, homesteaders growing weed. It was part of the culture, and you know, they basically gave it away and sold a little bit in the cities. The domestic cannabis industry emerged when the federal government, this is during the Nixon administration in the 70s, sort of declared the war on drugs. This was like the first war on drugs in the 1970s, and this led to the creation of like the DEA. And also classifying cannabis as a Schedule I narcotic. Now, at the time, we were getting most of our cannabis from Mexico, and Nixon increased sort of eradication efforts in Mexico, specifically spraying paraquat on cannabis in Mexico. And rather than eliminate the production, what happened, it's sort of like a balloon effect. My friend Dominic Corva, a geographer, talks about this balloon effect. It simply shifted production from Mexico to, in a way, Northern California. So, and I don't know if you remember, but in the 70s, there was this sort of movement among cannabis smokers around this issue of pesticide spraying, the paraquat pot. Right, there were protests. I remember reading about in New York City where people were protesting paraquat and said, "We don't want paraquat pot." Right. So what's interesting about this sort of cannabis policing in the 70s is it appears to have a sort of inadvertently prompted like adaptions in the cannabis industry domestically. So the Paraquat Program acted as like a farm aid program to California. So it stimulated domestic production in places like Emerald Triangle, Humboldt County, Mendocino, and Trinity County. And people, you know, in the U.S. wanted paraquat-free cannabis. So it's an interesting unintended consequence of the war on drugs. So we have this emergence of an industry in this particular region during the 70s. And outside sort of the paraquat spraying in Mexico, there were few environmental consequences in the industry in the 70s that we saw. But it was in the 80s where we had the militarization of eradication that really facilitated the growth of cannabis agriculture in this region and public lands trespass grows in this region. You have to think too, back then it's like $2,000 a pound people were getting for cannabis as a result of the inflated prices, as it was illegal. So Nixon's war on drugs was accelerated by Reagan, and you know, we had harsh criminal sentences that were laid out for cannabis growers, and also we had the creation of CAMP, the Campaign Against Marijuana Planting, and that was a federally funded crusade to eradicate cannabis agriculture in my region, Northern California. So as a result of you know, these new enforcement efforts of the feds, you know, folks started to do more guerrilla growing. They moved to go and grow on public lands, where in the past they were growing on their own land. They were then moving onto public lands. In addition, you had people moving towards more indoor, off-the-grid industrial cannabis production, with people growing off of generators in the hills. And they were growing inside. They'd build a shack out there and throw a industrial generator, and they'd grow indoor weed outside off the grid to avoid the helicopters that were flying all over the region. So we see this you know, in influence or the impact of the drug war on practices of cannabis agriculture in the 1980s. And when that 1996 rolls around with the passage of Prop 215, the medical marijuana law in California, we see even more shifts in production. And what we see is a movement towards indoor production on a scale that was unheard of prior to that. So we have these sort of pressures by the feds to actually encourage bad practices. So, you know, when you have a chopper flying over your house in October when you're ready to harvest, right? You lose your income. You know, what sort of thing do you do? Well, let's go in the woods. Let's go in the public lands, because I don't want to lose my property and I don't want to get arrested. And let's also grow indoor with a generator, which is, you know, environmentally destructive. Because I don't want to be seen from the sky. So you have this sort of, you know, inner action between federal prohibition and the practices of cannabis agriculture. And this continues throughout every administration, right? It's not something that's a Republican or a Democrat. Obama also had a very, I would say, inconsistent policies throughout around cannabis production and cannabis agriculture. So, you know, moving into that sort of the 90s, what we saw is you know, this indoor production boom. And with indoor production, as you know, when you grow anything indoor, you're going to need the monoculture, and you're going to need pesticides and other sort of toxins to grow it. And so what we saw in that era is a shift from outdoor agriculture to indoor agriculture, and reliance on nasty chemicals. And those are, you know, and I could get into some of the list of some of those impacts. You know, the pesticides are things like Furadan, Metaphos, Avid, Fluoramide, all of these things are highly toxic to humans and have never been tested for folks that are smoking. So these are really problematic pesticides that are used primarily for indoor agriculture. So you see that sort of stuff take off in the 90s. And again, the price in the 90s, you're looking at upwards to $3,600 a pound for cannabis at that time, which is, you know, I mean, now it's they're selling pounds out here, outdoor pounds, for as low as 500 right now. So it was literally advantageous to grow as much cannabis as possible. And, you know, when you have thousands of dollars invested into your crop, you know, folks just jump to the pesticides, and it's an easy way, right, to deal with some of these issues with growing in monocultures indoors.
So everything you're saying is making sense to me so far, and I'm a little confused though that if the prohibition has been one of the things pushing increased environmental degradation, but it seems to me that the sort of legalization or semi-legalization that's happening across the country is not, well, two things. One is that it also is creating environmental problems, and also I think of a conversation I had, and I've had several of these with different growers, but I was thinking about one I specifically had with a grower who's been growing since the 70s, who said he'd been dreaming his whole adult life about, he's from Oregon, he's been dreaming his whole adult life about legalization, but now that legalization has happened, he regrets that dream and wishes, and thinks it's not working well. And then also,
well, it's not working well because federal prohibition is still in place. I mean, that's one of the reasons, but we'll get back to that. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Okay. No, it's great. And then also along those lines, the first time that California put up something on the ballot for recreational legalization of recreational, I guess there's three things. So the second thing is the thing I'm saying now about Humboldt County voted against legalization, and that I find also interesting. And then the third thing I want to mention is that even if we talk about the full legalization of marijuana, I mean, industrial agriculture in general is a complete nightmare.
Horrible. Yeah.
You know, like this, I mean, if we want to, I mean, lettuce is legal, and the Central Valley has been devastated by lettuce, almonds, oranges. Mm-hmm. And the Great Plains have been devastated by wheat, and that's legal. So anyway, so I'm throwing all those three things out, and take any of them any direction you want.
Well, I should say one thing. You know, the prohibition efforts of the 80s and the 90s, for the most part, really led to what we consider to be like this geographical dispersion, I would say, of cannabis agriculture. So rather than just concentrate those environmental impacts of the industry in Humboldt County, it spread throughout other communities in California and onto public lands. So we have sort of the sort of federal legislation really sparking the growth of cannabis throughout California, right? So, you know, when we talk about legalization, you know, we have to remember that the prohibitionist model encourages you know, expansion of this particular industry in states where it's currently a gray area, currently it's not kind of legal, right? So people have like an out, if you will, right, with the medical. So and I don't know if I've answered that the question. I got distracted a little bit. But in terms of, you know, the problem your friend talks about in Oregon, I wish it was not, you know, wish it stayed illegal. I mean that's part of the problem. I mean, what we do is we have a quasi-regulated industry. I mean, there's this belief that people would, once we get it legal, we can regulate it, everybody would go in line. But with the federal sort of uncertainty about the feds. You know, I mean, they have a schizophrenic policy where they'll enforce sometimes and then they won't. And that leads people to think we can't trust the feds, right? And you have to remember, you know, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, the feds were saying, okay, if you have a medical cannabis law in your state, we're not going to come and enforce on you. And we had, you know, communities like Mendocino put together the Zip Tie program. And the Zip Tie program was a way to bring growers into compliance, right? Into compliance, both environmental compliance and also scale, right? And, you know, the first year, the sheriff's office got very few to sign up to that program. The second year after they didn't get enforced on, the second year more growers came and got those zip ties and helped to generate both tax revenue for Mendocino and also bring growers into compliance where they were actually, you know, they were actually doing the right thing in terms of environmental sustainability, scale, and whatnot. But a year after that, the feds came and they threatened the Mendocino lawmakers, and they said, if you don't give us your list who's on this program, we're going to arrest you all. And of course, the fears of the cannabis community at the time that, you know, that the feds were going to take this list, so let's not sign up, then they became a reality. And the Mendocino legislators then, you know, gave that list to the feds, and it killed that program. So every time there's an attempt to create legislation that is, you know, going to address issues of environmental sustainability and also economic sustainability, which is a whole different question. Can we do this? You know, green capitalism, I won't get into that right now. But the feds have come and they've made it impossible to even try. So your friend in Oregon, you know, I think I understand where he's coming from, because it's becoming more and more problematic for people who have had a long history in cannabis agriculture, the small mom and pops, to actually make it. Because now what's happening is we're having this sort of industrial cannabis industry emerge.
Well, and that's something that I if you don't mind me going off on a little rant here.
Please.
That's one of the things that I find most disturbing about the current legalization efforts is this is something we've seen. This is almost a natural progression. It's an unnatural progression in capitalism, in that it's an inevitable progression in capitalism that you move. It's like the Luddites were fighting against the conversion of the artisanal individual craftsperson into the large scale servant of the large scale sort of corporate machine. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've mentioned several times the transformation from mom and pop into larger scale. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, I know someone who knows someone who works as a trimmer at a legal grow up in Oregon that is a warehouse that basically the warehouse is the size of a couple football fields.
Yeah, 100,000 square feet. 100,000 square feet. And again, you have to think too of this, Derek, just to add, you know, years ago, I want to say 2012, Evan Mills from the Lawrence Berkeley Labs in Livermore estimated that in terms of electric consumption, 1% of electricity consumption is devoted to cannabis agriculture in the U.S. That's around $6 billion. Right. In California alone, it's 3%. And that was 2012. That's 3% of our electric grid. Right. So the demand for power, the greenhouse gases, you know, it's 1% is around 15 million tons of greenhouse gases. You're looking at 3 million cars. And that's 2012. Today, you know, it's probably at least double that in terms of greenhouse gases. And that is that's sort of encouraged by the state. So this indoor production model is encouraged by the state. Why? Because they could put a camera on it, right? And they could regulate it and take control over the production style, production methods. So this sort of – this is another unintended consequence of prohibition, but also the problem that we have with industrial capitalism, right? That appetite for growth, the appetite for – for expansion and for capital accumulation. And that is one of the effects is the appetite for energy. You know, power companies are now bending over backwards to offer cannabis farms a lower rate, right? And, you know, this whole notion of we need to grow cannabis indoors is one of the most ecologically insane notions that of late, if you will, right? You know, think about the scale from going from a small thousand square foot room to now you're looking at hundreds of thousands of square feet in warehouses. I mean, Colorado is pretty much entirely indoor agriculture. And what do you need for that? You need pesticides and other sorts of petrochemicals to control the mites and other things that emerge and the funguses that emerge in indoor agriculture. So you know, there's really no environmental consciousness, sadly, in this new regulatory regime. And I'll give you a great example. There is a California advisory board for cannabis, and it is they put out a request for people that wanted to sit on this California advisory board. And this is this was a requirement for the Cannabis Bureau. Like, they had to, you know, they need an advisory board. So many academics that I know that work on environmental issues put in their application to be part of this advisory board to guide cannabis policy in California. And they just released it a couple weeks ago. Folks can go online at the California portal for cannabis, and they released the names of the folks who they've chosen to sit on this advisory board, and not a single person is there that represents the interests of nature. They got someone from Trout Unlimited, whatever, right? But Trout Unlimited, I have no idea how or why that person got there. But folks like Murad Gabriel, who is like the nationwide, he's the worldwide expert in this stuff. He put his application in. Nope. So it shows, you know, the interest of these legislative efforts, especially in California, it's all about capital accumulation and tax dollars, right? So, you know, we talk about, you know, we're protecting the environment, but in the end, really, it's about generating revenue. And the appointment of those folks on that board with no representative to speak to environmental issues is a great example, right? It's sad. Sorry, I went on a little rant.
No, that's great. That's and thank you for that. And I'm wondering, with the momentum pointing toward increased legalization, at least on state levels, and probably the feds are going to follow, I'm guessing. Another concern I want to bring up, which is sort of the follow-up to my previous concern about the, you know, the Luddites and the turning of the artisanal into the corporate and industrial, is if legalization were to take place, okay, I'm going to back up. And we can presume that one of the reasons that Humboldt County voted against legalization the first time had to do with the destruction of the income of a lot of these mom and pop places.
Yes, people were fearful of the economic impact, for one. Another factor was just the poorly written initiative. Right. And, you know, poorly written. And as a result, I mean, 215 was poorly written for a reason. They made it as open as possible so that it was basically Dennis Perone and their folks' attempt at just legalizing. It didn't necessarily work to legalize it across the board, but it certainly made it open for anyone to get a card and to grow cannabis. So the second time around with the legalization effort, you know, folks pointed to how poorly written that one was. So you had a lot of resistance, and you didn't have really a good campaign. So yes, I mean, for sure, you have the locals here fearful of the economic impact, but also you have to consider it was a pretty crappy initiative.
Okay, so given that both you and I, and people who listen to this interview, you won't know this, but you and I have been friends for a decade or more. Mm-hmm. We both, our primary loyalty is to the natural world.
Yes.
And given that industrial capitalism is killing the planet, but industrial capitalism. Okay, given that industrial capitalism is going to stay for a little while, unfortunately, what would you do, given the momentum toward increasing legalization, what would you do to protect? They make you the U.S. czar for marijuana. And what would you do to protect the environment and to attempt to protect mom and pop artisanal growers as much as possible?
I would ban large industrial growers right off the bat. You know, limit the scale. Limit the scale. I mean, number one, you know, no 100,000 square foot grows anywhere. Just not going to happen, right? I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, there are permitting places now, indoor and outdoor, that are huge amounts of space, right? Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square feet, right? So that would be one of the first things I would do, right? The second thing I would release like a list of best management practices for people to actually read, right? I mean, for years, growers have been seeking advice on pest control, water conservation, and best management practices from not the industry, but from county agencies, from ag agencies and university extension programs. But for years, all those folks, they had federal money, they were unable to actually give people advice. It's only in the last year where federal and state agencies are now actually having those conversations about how to do it the right way. So, I mean, this is part of the educational process. Like, we are behind in terms of the best management practices. So certainly doing a better effort at getting BMPs out there for the industry. And then ban all indoor agriculture minus the medical. Because, you know, the concern, I mean, this is one of the concerns for medical folks, is they need the consistency. And right now, at least from folks that I've talked to, you know, having an indoor sort of environment for the production, people are arguing that they still sort of need that. I don't pretend to be a biologist or a scientist of that. So I take their advice, the folks that really use it for medicine, and want to protect their crops from, you know, other sorts of pesticides that are floating in the air from other farms. So I think, you know, certainly ban all of indoor agriculture minus those for medical, and I can go on and on, Derek.
Well, sorry to laugh, but if you were the czar for all things marijuana at the federal level and you banned indoor agriculture, I would strongly suggest that you not take a walk on a street in Colorado, or one of the people who is making $1 million a day there will shoot you.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, here is the the problem with how government policy impedes sensible ecological policy, right? And that is the failure of folks to really pursue alternative sources of energy. I mean, I'm not a sort of ecological modernization theorist. We'll say technology will save us for everything, but you know, there are ways if we need to use sort of energy for indoor production. There are, you know, solar panels and things that we can limit and minimize some of that impact. There are LED lights and technologies that if we put those resources into developing, we may be able to say a certain percentage can be devoted to or used by with this form of agriculture, right? Indoor agriculture. But you know, the government is consistently, the feds, impeding any advancement in the development of these technologies that can be much more ecologically sane and soft, if you will. So you know, yeah, I won't go to Colorado.
I hear what you're saying on all this, and I want to come back to, okay, so now you're no longer czar. You've been kicked out by the people in Colorado, and so let's go back to sort of the reality of modern capitalism and how everything gets centralized and turns into, I mean, this is the movement, the sociological movement of capitalism is the turning of the entire world into a company town. And what sort of, I mean, that is my concern about this legalization, is that Philip Morris buys up 10,000 acres in Humboldt County, and Humboldt County gets turned even more. Instead of having 10,000 illegal grows, you have one huge grow by Philip Morris, which I'm not sure how much better that is. And so how does one, this is probably way too big a question to ask for this, because this has not just to do with cannabis, but this has to do with Walmart. It has to do with any sort of agriculture where, you know, what is it, five companies now control most of the world beef supply and seven control the world rice supply, you know, whatever the numbers are. How does one, I mean, that's the thing that frankly has horrified me about the legalization in Colorado, Oregon, and everywhere, is that basically it's just a bunch of rich people who are throwing a bunch of money in and making money hand over fist and destroying once again the cottage industries. This is a larger problem than cannabis, but what the hell do we do?
Yeah, and that's what I think we're struggling with in this community, and there's lots of infighting within the cannabis community here about the direction forward and how to really address this sort of corporatization of the industry. One of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Fred Christman in anthropology, is you know, he describes this movement of the destruction of cannabis culture, toward this movement towards sort of, you know, corporatization, if you will. He's actually up in the hills right now doing some work trimming, and he's going to be going down and working on some farms. He may be someone also that you may be interested in talking to about this issue. But you know, I think part of it is organizing in our communities, cooperatives. We have folks like the CGA, the California Growers Association, which is a collection of cannabis cultivators who have sort of pooled their energy and their political sort of capital, if you will. I hate to use that word, capital, Jesus. But they're trying their best to help influence the policies at the state level, to some success and other times not, you know. I wish, Derek, if I had an answer to that. What's happening on the ground though here is that folks are not coming into compliance. I'll just be straight up. You know, we have 10,000 growers, we have 2,000, maybe 500 people that actually apply for permits. So you're looking around 75% of outdoor growers or cannabis cultivators in my region are going unregulated, and that is what happens when you have this sort of environment where the regulatory environment's uncertain, the licensing prices out the mom and pop, right? It prices out the mom and pop. Just to get a permit, you're talking 10, 12 grand just to get the process rolling to get a permit, right? To get into the permitting loop. And some folks just simply don't have that stashed away. They go season to season. So, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but right now there is uncertainty in the direction of this industry in our region. You know, people are basically packing things up and moving out. And when that happens, they do it in a way that's ecologically devastating. So with the sort of fear of the Philip Morrising of cannabis, right? People are out there trying to just go as big as they possibly can and hope that their neighbor gets busted before they get busted. And the result is, of course, devastation for critters, right? Wildlife, for nature, water. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it's great. And we're pretty close to out of time. Is there anything that you've wanted to say about this that I haven't given you opportunity?
You know, I think this is the big issue again. I think comes back to, you know, what are we doing when we try to regulate cannabis, right? And what is our goal? If our goal is for tax revenue, let's just be blatant about it, right? Let's just do it. Let's just talk about it and not give this facade of protecting the environment. I think it shocks me how little ecology is taken into consideration with this industry. You know, there's lots of lip service around environmental sustainability, but very few states have anything in place other than protecting the consumer, right? Which is important. Got it? Okay, there's pesticides, let's protect the consumer. But what about birds, right? What about salmon? What about, you know, forests? Like, they're not even there, right, yet in many of these states that have legalized it. You know, I've talked to somebody just the other day, and they were commenting, you know, because there's this trend in concentrating cannabis into dabs and oils of late. And when you concentrate it, the pesticides that people use are sort of in a way enhanced. They test positive. So many of the products are testing positive for pesticides and not being able to be sold on the medical or recreational market in different states. So what is disturbing is they're now creating techniques to remove those pesticides in the processing of the cannabis plant. Now, that is, I think it's great for the consumer, but it doesn't address the root problem here. You're still using pesticides, so you're still going to see this damage happen. So we have this great joy. Hey, we're going to remove pesticides and everything's going to test clean. It's like, great, we've just given the industry a magic bullet to get around doing things ecologically sort of minded, if you will. So it's really problematic. And this is the trend of the industry. I mean, this initiative here in California was written by big money people. They had no interest at all in social justice, getting people out of prison, right, or environmental impacts. There was nothing there or when this initiative really that addressed that. It was all about money. And you know, we really have to, you know, shift that mentality somehow.
Well, it seems like this conversation is going to end the same way that all of our conversations about what we need to do end, which is that we need to organize, and agitate.
Yes. Consistently and aggressively, for sure, you know. And we can't put our faith in these. And again, the political system here is it's basically a mouthpiece for capital. So I don't necessarily put much faith in that.
Well, this is great, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Tony Salvaggio. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.